talking with somebody at tea time today. They were describing how during the winter retreat at Chidhurst Monastery in England, one of the retreat help crew, like most of our monasteries, we have a retreat for 2 or 3 months in the winter time, and a group of people gather and help to take care of all of the tasks, cooking and errands and so on and so forth. And at Chidhurst Monastery during the winter retreat, then one of the people on the retreat help crew died during the course of the retreat. And this was very unexpected. The person didn't have any known illnesses, and even after he died, he was only 40 years old. They couldn't find couldn't pin down any particular cause. And he was out, went out on a town trip, just as we do here during our winter retreat. The various retreat helpers would pop into Ukiah to get a few things from Friedman Brothers or down to Raley's or to the Safeways for this or that. And so he went out on the town trip, didn't come back. So this is very sort of shocking, startling, in some ways, but also it shouldn't be shocking at all. One of the aspects of Buddhist practice, Buddhist meditation, is a cultivation, a development, a mindfulness of impermanence, of transiency, of mortality, that every single one of us, every person in this room, even though we don't like to think about it, or it's something we prefer to keep at a distance or use with a carefully guarded with euphemisms of one kind or another. Let's just say that not all of us will live forever. In fact, to be more direct, that every single one of us will die one day. Every single one of these bodies in here, in 100 years' time, I think we can guarantee that all of these bodies will have dissolved and gone their way. Our lives, these lives, will be over. Now, oftentimes, when people say come in contact with Buddhist teachings, and they encounter this kind of encouragement or this sort of emphasis, that you find that it can seem a little bit threatening or depressing, and that sometimes people get the impression that in Buddhism, Buddha's saying, all life is suffering, we're all going to die, we're just going to get sick and get old, it's all worthless. And it can be put across in that kind of way. And we feel a sort of shiver going through us. Oh, that's all very depressing. That's painful and heartless. And I remember years and years ago, there was a one of the nuns, actually Ajahn Chandasiri, who's coming here in a couple of weeks' time. She came from a very staunch of Scottish Christian family, and the parents were very very upset and not very keen on the idea of their daughter becoming a Buddhist. And this was a time when they got to meet one of the monks to chat with them and to be sort of reassured that Buddhism was a good and encouraging way of life. And I forget whether I was actually there in the room at the time, but I certainly heard it reported numerous times afterwards, where Ajahn Chandasiri's mother asked Ajahn Sajito, what do Buddhists believe happen when we die. And Ajahn Sujito, with astonishing directness and accuracy, although not incredibly diplomatically, said, "Well, the body rots," which wasn't exactly what Mrs. Coben was was looking for, I think it was. But I don't think Ajahn Sujito would reply in exactly the same way today. I think he would probably be a little bit more kind of a bit more spacious around it. But I mean, it's true. You know, either one way or another, you know, the body doesn't last; it breaks up and goes to pieces. But sometimes when we hear this kind of take on things, you know, that we can feel threatened, because certainly at that point in the conversation, you know, Mrs. Coben, Ajahn Chandasiri's mother, sort of went very quiet, and I think they changed the subject, as one does in Britain when things get difficult. We're not a sort of in-your-face type of culture. When things get difficult, you either put the kettle on, or you change the subject at least. So, so sometimes it can be misinterpreted, or things can be put forth in a way which is a bit too blunt, or doesn't give the whole picture. Because it certainly is true, you know, in the Buddha's teaching about mindfulness, development of mindfulness, the key meditation teaching about the development of mindfulness, and he praises, you know, the fact that mindfulness is indeed the one essential element for liberation, that this is the most crucial of spiritual qualities, to be mindful, to truly know what's happening in this moment, to understand and to bring a quality of wholehearted awareness to what we're experiencing. And then the first element of mindfulness training, mindfulness of the body, includes a lot of contemplations of death. Actually, the majority of the body contemplations, you know, kaya nupassana, mindfulness of the body, is about the mortality, understanding the frailty and mortality of the body. And so that, when we look at that again, if we take a sort of materialistic view or a narrow view, it can seem pretty depressing or threatening. Or you're supposed to dwell upon the fact that the body is going to die and is also going to degenerate and fall to pieces and rot and break up into bones and become dust and so on. But there's a reason why the Buddha encouraged that, and it's not just to belabor or to create a sort of depressive feeling. I mean, that's the whole point of this is to not suffer. The whole point of Buddhist teaching and Buddhist practice is to learn how to not create suffering, learn how to know peace, to know ease, to know freedom. So what this is doing is pointing to those instinctual reactions that we have within us, that in us which is rejecting of the actuality of death, that sort of that very powerful instinct in us that makes us draw away from anything that refers to death or loss or mortality. There's a powerful instinctive drives that we experience that make us pull away, that make that something that's repellent or threatening. And just as physical pain is something that's uncomfortable, or is something that when we begin to experience something that harms the body or damages the body, it feels painful, so we get away from it. Or similarly, fear of fast moving objects, or fear of heights, or such like things. You know, we feel tense and agitated. We want to get away because there is danger there. So it's fear is an uncomfortable feeling, so that we'll get out of the dangerous situation. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. The creatures who had a fear reaction, when they met with danger, they felt all sort of gooey and cheerful. They were the ones that got hit by the falling rocks or got jumped on by the saber-toothed tigers. You know, they were the ones that fell over the cliffs. So those of us who, our ancestors got to the edge of the cliff and went, step back. They are the ones that survived. So fear is an uncomfortable feeling, but it's supposed to be, so it helps us. So similarly, you know, the reason why the sort of death is repellent or off-putting is so that we'll get away from the dangerous situations. We'll protect ourselves, protect our loved ones. It's a very deeply rooted instinctual reaction that's there to help us, you know, as a living being, as a creature. It means, you know, if we see a dead body or we smell a dead body, then something in us wants to withdraw, wants to get away, wants to get out of there, because on instinctive level, this happened to her, you could be next, get out, leave now. And this is all, you know, from the eras of our development, so way before we developed language and so forth. This is, you know, very, very, very ancient instinctual reactions, you know, very basic. And so that, like so many of the other aspects of Buddhist teaching, the Buddha encourages us not to sort of condemn or to ignore those instinctual forces, but to understand them. Just as when we're attracted towards something, you know, the Buddha encourages a development of dispassion or coolness towards the things that are intrinsically, you know, exciting or pleasing to us, you know, like, you know, food or sense pleasure of one kind. Then it's the Buddha says, well, understand that feeling of attraction that says this is good. It's just food. You know, it's good because you're hungry. When you're full, it's not good anymore. It loses its, you know, if your stomach is full, that cheesecake that looked ever so interesting is suddenly, ooh, right? Or when you're hungry and you walk past the house here in the morning and your belly's growling and you smell some food type fragrances coming out, billowing out of the windows, you go, it's interesting. When your stomach is full, and you go past the window and you smell the, or you come in here and you think, wow, this place really stinks. Same smell. Empty stomach, full stomach, ugh. This is how we work. This is how the systems operate. So that the Buddha encouraged the contemplation of death to help us to understand that kind of revulsion or that kind of reactivity against it, a fear of it, hatred of it, rejection of it. And by raising it up, by raising up the recognition of, yeah, this life is not going to last forever, that sooner or later we're going to have a moment coming when the body breathes out and doesn't breathe in again. That's going to come one day, one way or another. Sooner or later, it's going to happen. And we don't know when. And so that it's just understanding that kind of fending that off, and that refusal, and that instinct in the heart that doesn't want to acknowledge that, is to understand that refusal, that rejection, to understand it, to know it, and not to be dominated by that, but to be able to see things more realistically. That's why we raise this quality up, or we look at it, we kind of bring it to mind and contemplate our own mortality and contemplate that, you know, the loss of the body, the aging of the body, and so forth. I'm very fond of quoting a particular passage in the Bhagavad Gita, Actually, it's not the Bhagavad Gita, it's in the Mahabharata, where in the story there's a great Indian epic, and it's at a particular time where the five Pandava brothers, the heroes of the story, they have been off on one of their adventures, and four of them have been knocked out and apparently kind of inert or unconscious by some strange presence arising from this mysterious lake, and then the last of the ones left standing, the elder of the brothers, then is being questioned. This sort of mysterious disembodied voice puts these questions, and he has to get all of them right, otherwise disaster will follow. So there's a whole long series of questions that appear out of the mist in the lake, and one of the questions that the prince is asked is, what is the most extraordinary and wonderful thing in the world, or the most sort of incredible or strange extraordinary thing in the world? And he says, the most extraordinary and strange thing in the world is that even though every single one of us is going to die, every one of us thinks it won't happen to me. And that was the right answer. Even though every single one of us is going to die, we all think somehow it's not going to happen to me. So one of the useful reflections, when I was down in Berkeley, giving the talk there this week, the same theme came up. It arose today again, quite by chance. But I think it's certainly something that bears reflection on. And say like this experience of this fellow in England, David Miller. Just went off to town on a town trip, didn't come back. He probably hadn't got through his list of things he had to do in town. There you go with your little checklist, of and at some point along the way he just keeled over and was taken off to the local clinic or hospital and died there that day. And so that kind of unbiddenness, that kind of unexpectedness, that not all of us are going to be able to plan exactly how we depart. You might think, I want to die is I'd like to be in a monastery, I'd like to have people around me, all the kind of monks and nuns, and people chanting the appropriate verses, and so I can be taking refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. It's like, well, good luck. you can sort of set that intention and rig it that way, but it could be that you're rushing about on a town trip, or you're in the middle of putting up your Christmas decorations, or just finishing sending somebody a letter, or just popping downstairs, and next thing you know, our foot has slipped, or we've dropped off a stool, or just popping across the road, and a car appears out of nowhere and hits us, or just like with this fellow, some strange illness, or some. Sudden collapse suddenly strikes us, or that we have a more chronic illness. We're laid low by a more chronic illness, and we fade out slowly. We don't know how it is that we're gonna die, but we can be sure that one day it's gonna happen. And this is the kind of exercise there's several exercises I like to do and encourage is to contemplate, that every single one, there's a day of the week that we're all going to die on, Every week we have like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Well, at least one of those is going to be the day that I die on. Well, you know, are you going to be, is your death going to be a Tuesday death? Are you a kind of Tuesday death, or maybe a Sunday, you know, weekend, that'd be more convenient, wouldn't it? Or do you think a January death, or a July death, or an April death, or maybe an August? And that the fact is, there's one of those days, one of those months, one of those days of the week, that's going to be our day. And even though we might not sort of wake up in the morning and think about this on an ordinary day, it's the fact, isn't it? Every single one of us. I mean, I'm not putting forward the idea that it's sort of predestined and there's already, you know, August the 3rd is your day or my day. Although Ajahn Amara has secret knowledge that on February the 31st, ...2853 is going to be the day. But here is the calendar. You know, here's our life. It's going to be one day. It's going to be our death day. And so just different ways that we can bring it into consciousness. Of, oh yeah, right, that's the fact. It's going to be one of those days. One of these days. It's going to have my name on it. And just making that real and allowing that into the heart. And the reason why we can raise up the fact of death and allow it in and really acknowledge that is so that when we do that, then we are able to see, to know, to feel that the undercurrent of anxiety, the undercurrent of rejection, that in us which is constantly trying to push that away and rejecting it and pretending it's not going to happen, because that is an intrusive and abrasive quality on the heart. It's a noise. Going on and on and on in the background, or a stone in our shoe, or a kind of weight that we're carrying. It is a tension within our heart that we carry it around all the time, so we don't notice it. But when we raise it up and look, it's like, yeah, there's this pain in my foot. Okay, you take the boot off, shake out, think, ah, it's a rock. Ah, now there's that horrible pain in my foot's gone. Oh great, you know, they turn the engine off, so now it's silent. Or I can put this bag down. Ah, what a relief. So it's that kind of recognition of this sort of burdensome, abrasive, intrusive quality that we're just not acknowledging. That when we look at, when we raise it up and think, yeah, why am I afraid of that? Why do I push that away? What's the problem there? So the point of it is not to say be morbid or to create the kind of depressive feelings, because you might think, well, whenever I think about death, I just get depressed. Well, if as long as we identify with the body and with the personality, then yeah, it's understandable why death is depressing or kind of off-putting, because if we believe that, you know, this is the body is all and everything, then with its ending, then everything is gone. But the point of looking at death and contemplating it and bringing that up in this way is precisely because we're not the body. The body is not self. Feelings are not self. Perceptions are not self. Mental formations are not self. These basic reflections and considerations of these insights that the Buddha pointed to is that it's only if the body was self, if this is truly who and what we are, completely who and what we are, then it would be a problem. But it's like, and that's why the feeling of death being a terrible bad thing, it's like, well, it's only a bad thing if the body is who and what we are. But when we look at that reaction and we allow that in and we allow ourselves to acknowledge the insight that, wow, yeah, the body is born and dies, and it's present, and there's an experience of the body, but there's that which knows the body, that which is aware of it, that which is not tied to the body, that which is not limited by the body, not limited by the personality, by memory or ideas or feelings or emotions. There's this dimension of our being which is transcendent of that. Aha! So that the point of these reflections on death or developing an awareness of death and seeing the quality of mortality and reflecting on the unexpectedness or the fact that we don't know when this is going to die, that it can help, or the point of it is to help us to awaken to the deathless, that the transcendent quality of our being, that in a aspect of our nature which was not born, which does not die, which is not bound up to time or to self or to any kind of limitation, that in us which is primordial, if you like, that fundamental transcendent quality of our nature. So it's a mysterious thing. It's ironic also that it's through one of the ways that we develop that understanding or that insight into the deathless, the unborn, the transcendent, is through the facing and the acknowledging, the opening the heart to the quality of death. And it's also strange that as long as we sort of reject death or fear death or are threatened by that, or we identify with the body and with the birth and death process, then the gateway to the deathless, the insight into that dimension of our nature is closed, it's blocked, it's obstructed. So it's a strange way that this works. It's a mysterious thing, but through a mindfulness of the body, the insight into the nature of the body, and then recognizing the selfless nature of the body, the letting go of identification with the body, then that leads to the awakening to this other dimension of our being. As long as we're caught up in that rejection, then somehow it's impossible to really open to that insight. It's only when we turn towards that and recognize it and then see that there's no thing there to fundamentally be afraid of, that that which is born and that which is dying is not self anyway, so you know, there's really no problem. Then we are able to awaken to this quality of the deathless. Now when we start to use this kind of language, we talk about ultimate reality or the transcendent or the deathless, it all gets to sound, maybe sound a little sort of woo-woo, or oh dear, this all sounds like, you know, New Agey California psychology. Yeah. I thought Buddhism was practical and talked about, you know, suffering and the end of suffering and that kind of thing. Well, it does, but it also we can equally use this kind of language, not to create an image of some sort of abstract heavenly realm, or to try and just create an idea, but also it's pointing to an already existent quality. And so we might terms like ultimate reality or the deathless, the unborn, these are not everyday terms. These are things that we not words that we use in a ordinary conversation. Well, maybe maybe in a monastery you do, but in most households, most workplaces, this doesn't come up that often. But these are useful terms and principles to contemplate and to bring to mind to develop the use of, because they can help map out the reality of what is, and can help us to see beyond the habitual limitations of our personality, our body, our possessions, the world of birth and death. You know, the very inspiration that the Buddha had to take up the spiritual path, as it's described in the teachings, he said, "Why should I, subject to aging, to ailment, to sickness, to death, also seek after, chase after things that are similarly subject to aging, to sickness, to death? Why should I not instead seek the unaging, the unailing, the unborn, the undying, the deathless?" And so, and then he, on that reflection, on that insight, he said, "Yes, I will. That's what I will do. I will seek the unborn, the unaging, the unailing, the deathless." He had the insight, the intuition that that was a potential that he had, that there was something that we all have, and that it's through that recognition, that acknowledgement of that dimension of our being, following up that intuition of, yeah, there's something in me, something in our hearts which is utterly free, which is utterly unlimited, which is utterly at ease and peaceful, that is clear and awake and joyful, that is fundamentally tranquil, peaceful. Something in us knows that, even despite all the evidence to the contrary. And that in Buddhist practice, it's the goal of all of the different kinds of trainings that we have in generosity, in morality, in meditation, in wisdom. They're all ultimately directed towards the realization of Dhamma, of the way things are, of this fundamental quality. And again, in another well-known teaching that the Buddha gave, he said, "There is the unborn, the unconditioned, the unoriginated, the unformed. This does exist. And if there were not the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the unformed, then there will be no hope of escape, no hope of transcendence for any being from the born, the created, the formed. But because there is this unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed, there is hope, there is the possibility of liberation, of transcendence, of true freedom from the born, from the created, from the formed." So, and that's a more formal way or structured way of describing what I was saying before. It's like it's only when we are identified with the body, identified with the personality, that then death is threatening. You know, if I am the body, then death is definitely off-putting and dangerous and bad. But because of there is the actuality, there's the insight into the actuality of, you know, the body is not self, the personality is not truly self, it's not totally and absolutely who and what we are. There is that dimension of our nature which is unborn, which is undying, which is timeless, selfless, unlimited. Therefore, death should not be frightening. Death does not need to be threatening. You know, loss and aging and ailment and so forth are not ultimately dangerous. They're not ultimately threatening. They're not ultimately harmful, because there is that element of our nature, that dimension of our being, which cannot be touched by those, which is intrinsically separate. And Ajahn Chah, our teacher, used to use the analogy of oil and water, saying that, you know, it's like oil and water, when they're in a bottle together and you shake them up, then they seem to be, you know, one liquid. But when you set the bottle down, then the oil and water separate out. And he said, similarly, this is how it's like. This is what it's like with the mind and its objects, or the quality of awareness or knowing. You know, that's this transcendent awareness is on the one side, and then there's the objects of awareness. There's the world and people and things and trees and cars and rocks and sky. There's the, you know, the body, the thoughts and feelings, memories, ideas, all of the objects of the internal and external world. Those are the water, and then the oil is the that quality of awareness, that which knows them, that which is there in the same bottle. They're sort of in there together, but they're fundamentally separate. And it's because they're separate, therefore freedom is possible, therefore liberation is possible, therefore true contentment, true ease is possible. Because how beautiful the heart is, how relaxed the heart can be when something good or delightful happens and we can enjoy it. Something painful and difficult happens and we can bear it. It's not as though when something good happens we have to sort of grab it and possess it and keep it, or when something bad happens then we're somehow damaged or corrupted or diminished by that. There's a knowing of it. There's a knowing of the beautiful and of the ugly and of the neutral. There's an attunement to that. The heart is aware of it, is sensitive to it, is with it, but it's not of it. It's not of the same nature. So therefore we can be with we be with the world, we can be with our personality, with our body, with the events of the day, and take care of our, you know, 10,000 duties and concerns, but there isn't that feeling of burdenedness or limitation, that feeling of confinement. There's a spaciousness, an ease, a relaxed quality that the heart, with which the heart can appreciate all of life, and a responsiveness that we're able to respond to the needs of each moment, to the needs of the people around us, to the needs of the world, to the needs of our own body and mind, without being anxious or hopeful for particular outcomes or fearful of particular outcomes. We do what we can in response to the world and then leave it alone. We are at ease with how things unfold. And that allows the heart to rest in this quality of pure responsivity. We do what we can, and we help out in the ways that we can, but we're not looking for a kind of satisfaction or fulfillment with a particular result, and we're not threatened or frightened or worried about, you know, loss or diminution or harm through painful results. There's just an openness, an ease, and a resonance with the way things are. So these are some thoughts to consider, contemplate for the evening. Please take whatever might be useful and take that with you, and whatever is not, then just please leave it behind. Amen.